From the Sky News Centre at 5, Lord Jan has been ordered to go to court to face a series of historical sex abuse allegations. The chief magistrate considered medical evidence about the elderly Labour peer's severe dementia, but concluded he was fit to attend. He denies allegations of abuse between the 1960s and 80s. Our reporter Tom Parmenter's at Westminster Magistrates and says the legal teams will meet early next week to look at how it might work.
Whether he will be physically in this building next Friday or whether there will be some other mechanism for getting him to attend, but the chief magistrate adamant in his view that Lord Jana must attend and the legal process will follow on from there.
Police in France are investigating reports Jenson Button and his wife were gassed in a robbery at their villa. £300,000 worth of goods were taken, but claims an anaesthetic was pumped in through their air conditioning system are being disputed. There are claims it's not uncommon on the French Riviera, but Dr. Liam Brennan, Vice President of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, says it doesn't sound likely.
It just wouldn't be possible. To get somebody to be unconscious, you would have to have concentrations well in excess of 90%. And of course, if you're giving the atmosphere with that much nitrous oxide in it, there would be no oxygen to go along with it.
It could take several days for the tap water in Lancashire to get back to normal. Thousands of people in Blackpool, Chorley and Preston have been advised to boil their drinking water after a parasite was found in the supply. David Cameron's defending the government's decision to grant £3 million to the charity Kids Company. He says it was right to offer it one last chance, despite its closure this week amid allegations of sexual abuse and financial mismanagement. And three supermarkets are planning to cut the cost of fuel by tomorrow. Tesco, Sainsbury's and Asda are taking 2p off a litre of diesel and 1 pence off unleaded. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Maggs.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is stuck on the M4, but we hope he's here soon. After the 6 o'clock news, LIBOR trader Tom Hayes is jailed for 14 years. But is the long sentence just punishment, a just punishment, or to keep him from giving evidence to journalists and the courts about his managers and directors that knew exactly what he was up to? Billionaire bosses at RBS, Royal Bank of Canada, Citigroup and, yes, Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS, that we heard from former US Army officer Scott Bennett a few weeks ago, that very bank was channeling secret money to ISIS. Too big to jail banksters? Is that why Tom Hayes wasn't allowed to turn Queen's evidence? No justice, no peace, so the demonstrators' chant goes. But can there be justice with massive cuts to the legal aid bill? Any tin pot dictator knows the best way to get his way is to take over the courts. But could the same be happening here in Britain, with only the rich getting access to lawyers? Also, the strange case of Alexander Litvinenko, Russian investigative journalist, who came to a sticky end in London. Like Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, he was poisoned with radioactive polonium. And what was his relationship with the exiled Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky? Also, as Turkey changes targets from ISIS to the PKK, the US follows suit by announcing they will start to target the allies of President Assad in Syria. Meanwhile, Russian parachute forces chief Vladimir Shamanov gets a ticking off from Putin for announcing his boys are ready to descend on Syria and lend Uncle Sam a hand fighting ISIS. Despite satellites and the latest technology money can buy, the Americans apparently are having trouble hitting them. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 23 Celsius, sunny on Saturday, cloudy and breezy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 22 and sunnier midweek, cloudier and wetter the rest of the week. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of August, highs of 21, sunshine and showers. I can hardly believe I was swimming in the Gower this time yesterday. Absolutely beautiful weather it was in South Wales. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Hi, George. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Now, you have a budget of something like £350 million, is it? Something like that.
Thereabouts,
and about 350,000 people, so that's about £1,000 per person you're spending. Are you spending it wisely?
Extremely wisely. We have to be really, really clever with it now because, as you know, the government have made the money a lot tighter and at the same time have thrown a lot more problems at us. So we are much, much more efficient than we were ever since 2012, and we are driving greater efficiencies. But we've also got to invest to save. So sometimes that means capital expenditure in order to save on some of the revenue costs that if we overspend will bring us down.
So have you been batting for Bristol? I mean, this is one of the things I can remember when you were in the running for mayor a few years ago, George. You were saying, well, I'm going to be up there batting for us. What have you done about the fact that there seems to be complete myopia economically with this government, in that they don't seem to actually really want to fix the long-term problems there are with the national and the global economy, which is effectively which is run effectively by Wall Street and the City of London. The government needs to stand up to them, and it doesn't seem to me that George Osborne is really going to do that.
Well, I had a very good meeting with Government Minister yesterday, and James Wharton, who is dealing particularly, he was dealing with the Northern Powerhouse, and he's now talking with us about devolution in this area. And because I want a much better deal than we've got, so we are knocking very hard on their door. I get good access to government, both via the Core Cities group and direct access, partly because I am an independent mayor, and I think that they respect that Bristol is getting on and doing things. So we're not doing badly, but I'm always looking for more. But I'm not on my knees asking for more. What I'm saying is that we need to get greater realization in government that Bristol is a successful city, is contributing positively to the national economy, and that by investing in Bristol, investing in what we do, getting us better housing, which is an absolutely key issue in a place with high cost residential property, which is high cost for both renting and buying, that we need to invest much more in our housing. But so I'm having a big talk about that, because if you're poor in Bristol, you're poorer because you're spending a larger proportion of your hard-earned funds on.
But do
on
you buy
housing.
Into the whole austerity thing, George? This is one of the big questions, isn't it? There's an economic argument. Some economists say it makes sense to be doing austerity. Others say it's a complete waste, as our Martin Summers does here week after week. So it's a complete waste of time. Effectively, what it does is it kills the economy off because people haven't got the money to spend.
Well, I think we've got to get it in balance. I don't want us to find that, you know, that we move in the way that.
So where are you
moved.
In that balance, though?
I'm mixed in that I don't I'm not quite on the Jeremy Corbyn wing. I agree with many of the things he said. For instance, he would agree with me about housing and that we should throw a hell of a lot of money at housing, because that's investing in the future. It's investing in jobs. It's investing in reduced costs of housing. And instead of the government giving away some of our social and affordable housing, and you know, this second round of right to buy is going to be extremely damaging. So on many respects you could say I was on the left. On in other respects, in terms of fiscal matters, you might find me further to the right. So I'm not going to be pigeonholed into a particular position, but I will judge every single decision as to whether it's in the best interest of the people of Bristol, and especially the most vulnerable.
Do you think the central government edict, this whole austerity business then, is actually helping, or is it not? Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's all to do, isn't it, with whether we can actually pay back the national debt. That's what the whole point of this is, the deficit, yep. Paying back the deficit. Well, and do you think it's actually, because it doesn't look as if it is actually working, does it?
Well,
this is a fundamental thing, George, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a moral dimension to this.
We're about 1.2 trillion in debt. Yeah. We're much more in debt than we were when austerity started.
Yeah, but there is a moral dimension to it. But if we'd just opened the coffers, we would be in greater debt. I think you've got to get this in proportion. I don't want to leave my children and my grandchildren with debt that is almost impossible to service. I think it's really important. Well, you know, you wouldn't you wouldn't want to do that.
But George, that's the case now, isn't it? Surely, we're not going to service this debt. The debt is growing. National debt is growing at an enormous rate. We're not going to service it. You and I, never mind our grandchildren.
Well, I think, yeah, but you make it worse just by, you know, just by saying spend, spend, spend. That is not a good way forward. So it's like all things. It's not about. There's a real danger of generalization. And so I'm not going to fall into the trap of generalization. I think I agree with some of the things that are said on the left. I agree with some of the things that are said certainly in the middle, very seldom with the things that are said on the right, and certainly not the not on the far right. So I think it's always a judgment in each individual case as to what it's going to do to the individuals who scraping a living in the city, who have other challenges, and I'm absolutely determined that we deal with the most vulnerable in the city.
Most of your agenda, I suppose, has been to do with managing this cuts process, but are you not questioning it at all? I mean, look at the state where we are now. I mean, surely we are heading the way of Greece. If we carry on like this, we're going to be cutting and cutting and cutting until we've got virtually nothing left, just like Greece.
Yeah, but I could put a load of energy into fighting it and then not getting on and dealing with it. I've got to deal with it. I think Bristol is doing really well. We're being entrepreneurial in many of the things we're doing. We're finding new ways of doing things. We're finding ways of serving more people with less money, which is a vitally important thing. We have crises that crop up that we have to deal with, such as the Kids Go One that has just hit us in the last couple of days, which we're dealing with extremely well. And I think the national media recognise that Bristol is facing up to that extremely well. I want to be in a position so we can deal with things. Well, if I just ignore and spend money on extravagant or unnecessarily expensive services, I won't be able to. I won't be able to respond to such issues.
Do you think it's justified to go along to trips like the one you went on last year if mayors ruled the world?
Absolutely. Every single trip that I make, every single visit that I make is based on making Bristol a better place. And what's more, we're now a small global city. We're recognised in the world as playing a part in the world, and particularly because of our position as European Green Capital. I've got people beating their door to us. I've got people talking about Bristol right across the world. And unless they know about Bristol, they're not going to invest in it.
But do you think that sends the right message about you, George?
And I want to make quite
sure
that we have jobs for
George,
people in Bristol.
Do you think it sends the right message about you if mayors ruled the world? This isn't even an official kind of local government association or any kind of official event.
No, it's nothing about me.
Tell us a bit about the event.
No, it's nothing about me. It's a recognition that leaders of cities are closer to the issues and are much more likely to know the solutions than national governments. And that's a refrain I hear right across the world. When I meet the mayor of New York, the mayor of Mexico City, the mayor of Buenos Aires, the mayor of Seoul in Korea, wherever it may be, there is a general agreed theme that we are much closer to the issues and the problems and the solutions than national governments.
So do you think mayors should, George?
And this is a trend that is being increasingly recognised.
So if they're closer, do you think mayors should rule the world?
It's, I mean, the term of mayors rule the world is just simply one to bring attention to that issue of mayors, city mayors, playing a really important role in, for instance, climate change. We're not going to tackle climate change, we just leave it to national governments. Most of the solutions and most of the problems lie in the cities. And that's why mayors play a very, very important role and are leading in this. So mayors are, in a way, ruling or leading in terms of the vitally important issue of leaving a better world to our children instead of a worse one. That's something, you know, that has a big moral dimension to it.
It certainly does. And what do you think, cancellation of unpayable debt, does that play a part in what mayors have got to offer the world?
I think cancellation of unpayable debt sometimes is relevant. And, you know, there's nothing worse than, it's a bit like a national version of not paying your parking fine. You know, I met a guy yesterday who didn't pay his 25 quid parking fine. He's now at 100 quid and he feels really angry and frustrated about it. And if he doesn't do it, he'll get 200 quid. And, you know, I think there comes
a
point
in national...
It's not
a very good analogy, George. Because this is a lot to do with people who cannot pay.
Yeah, no,
countries,
absolutely.
Countries that cannot pay.
No, that was
pay.
A guy who has got himself into a difficult situation. I feel extremely sorry for him. But what I'm saying, it is an analogy, because there are many countries that their debt has piled up because of the interest, and it does become really difficult. And I do think there are sometimes cases when that there should be a break to give them a chance. So absolutely, but you can't make a rule of it, and everybody will look to the exception.
But one of the cuts that's under consultation at the moment is the Bush Residential Care Home, and I'm joined by Rita Lynch, whose son Jimmy goes to the Bush. Rita, can you just tell us a bit about the place?
The Bush, it's an amazing resource. It's a respite centre for children who are disabled, and it takes 10 children a night. It's got 10 beds. My son Jimmy's been using it for the last 4 years. He goes one night a week. And what's so amazing about it is it's fantastic for the parents, because you can really trust it, because it has a team of qualified, experienced staff who know how to deal with these children. So you can trust, as a parent, you can trust your child is really well looked after and really safe and really protected. Plus, the children really enjoy it because the staff make sure that the combinations of children work really well each night. Say, for instance, because my son wasn't very verbal when he first started, they made sure he was with children who were more verbal so that he actually learned. So it's not just a place where, as a parent, you send your child to get a break. The child actually learns and gains something from being there.
George, what are your thoughts about what's happening with the Bush? Because you're actually, at the end of the day, you're the person that signs off whether these cuts happen or not. Rita was told around about a year ago, we've had a good look at the Bush, we don't think it's a good idea to close it. And now there's another consultation. It looks like, you know, I've got a statement from the City Council here, which is from Amy Bullen, who says, we appreciate that families using the respite service are under great pressure. We need a break from time to time. However, many families are choosing alternative ways in which they want their services delivered for those they care for. We're increasing the availability of direct payments and other targeted short breaks while retaining the majority of our residential provision. All of this is aimed at giving families a greater choice and control, and has enabled us to create short breaks for 50 more disabled children in the city. We're in communication with all families who use the Bush, and many of them will have no reduction in their service. We want to reiterate that disabled children and their families will continue to get their needs met for the residential short breaks in Bristol.
But the key thing I was going to say.
The key thing there is most families at the Bush, Rita,
Jimmy is able to carry on in the Bush.
I had a letter saying that Jimmy's place was going to be able to use it, but George, I've checked on that. I do want to inform you, I think I need to let you know that yes, Jimmy's going to keep his place.
I knew that some even of the though I didn't know will. You were coming today.
But the whole nature of the Bush will change when there's less children using it. When there's only 5 beds and 5 children using it a night, it will become more of an emergency resource respite centre, and it won't have the combinations of children, which is so crucial to the well-being of the child when they stay there, will really, really change. So, for instance, the children will be maybe more severely disabled, and they won't get as much from it. So it will change. Yeah, Jimmy's place, they've reassured me it will stay.
I'm pleased about that.
But it will change. The whole nature of the Bush will change. And when Jimmy first went, there was a waiting list because you have to get referred by your social worker. And What I'm here for really is to appeal to you to leave the Bush, because it's only 10 beds and there's only 5 other beds. In the whole of Bristol, there's 15 beds.
No, there's 10 it's, other beds, yeah. In the whole
there's
of
5 at the New Bellbrook and there's 10 at the Bush. There's 15 altogether. If anything, we need more. And I know what the statement says that Tony just read out is that there's other things. Well, the thing is, when I was given the choice of the Bush, I was offered at the time foster. There are other things. They've been there for a very long time. But most parents didn't want to do foster because there was a meeting at the Bush. We prefer the Bush because it's so much safer, because there's a team of staff. You're not just relying on one kind woman or one couple to look after your child. And we know that nobody can get at these children. They're just so safe. They're so very well looked after and protected. Given that some of these children are non-verbal and have very complex needs, very complex. I also would find it, I can imagine it's going to be very hard to find foster parents who can cope with the nature of these children disabilities. At the Bush, you have a sensory room, you have computers, you have a really big outside area. Well, how can a foster home will not have those amazing resources? And say Jimmy was a very mummy orientated child. Since he's been using the Bush, he's got so much more independent. He talks about the other boys. You wouldn't have that in a foster environment. And also direct payments and the other things that you're saying, which is really unclear from the statement what exactly they are offering, they don't compare with the overnight facility, because sometimes with the nature of autism, your child wakes up all night. Sometimes the best thing is an overnight break where you know your child is really safe and happy and also going to maybe learn something from what they're from the bush, and then you can really relax and get the break that you really need so that you can continue with your caring role. Because what happens to some families is that they break down and they end up losing their child to full-time residential, which would end up costing so much more.
Can I just put yourself in my position. I think Jimmy goes to Hengrove to swim, doesn't he? And that together with the bush. So when he goes
on his night, yes,
he goes on Mondays, goes to Hengrove swimming pool, and that's great. And he'll be able to continue to do that. You put yourself in my position. This is not a cut. This is about a redirection of money for similar purposes. But we need to service so many more. And if I can provide services for 50 more children by having direct payments, by having other ways.
But we already have
other
direct payments.
Yeah, by having other forms of respite, to use that over £300,000 that is saved by those five beds, then we are servicing many, many more children. And many of the service users and their parents or their carers of the bush have decided to take that alternative and are very happy with it. So I understand the attachment, and I totally
it's
sympathetic
not just an
with
attachment,
it. No,
actually.
But I'm totally sympathetic
That's quite
with
insulting.
It. No, it's not.
It is.
I do understand that.
It is.
And you know, it's perfectly fair to call it an attachment, and that is what you have with the bush.
My
and
son
I and that is
and
great.
These children are not just an attachment, they're real people.
No, I'm talking about your attachment to the bush. That is a perfectly reasonable way of
George,
describing
because
it.
What you're implying there is there's some sort of emotional thing. It's not, is it? It's actually about why we pay
our taxes.
We pay our taxes for facilities like this, and this is one of the things which really is at the sharp end of the cuts. Yeah. Let's be honest about it. There are cuts.
I'm being absolutely honest about it, Tony. This is not a cut. What it is spreading the money further to be able to give services and to give respite. Could you not interrupt? To be able to give respite to more young people. And that's what I really care about in this city. The vulnerable young people absolutely come top of my list of the people we need to look after in this city. And so I'm absolutely certain that having talked to other users that, and some of whom are very happy to take alternative offers, that this is going to result in more services for more young people who desperately need them. So I'm faced with these choices, and I think you have to respect the fact that I in the end have taken a decision was taken in October 2014, so there's been a lot of lead up to this, so there are no surprises, and we will, we're taking into account people's wishes.
Okay, George, I am going to interrupt you here because this is a bit of a surprise, because Rita was promised that the place was going to stay open.
No, she wasn't.
Etc.
No, she
wasn't. Last year, I thought you were, Rita. That's my understanding. Yeah, what I see here, George, maybe I'm wrong, but what I see here, it's a little bit like this whole care in the community where mental homes were closed down. People were told, oh, it's okay, we'll give you payments in the community. Those payments were slowly gone. What often happens in situations like that is once the institution itself is reduced and closed, then actually the people are isolated and on their own. They're not actually being cared for in an institution. And those institutions, whether it be a hospital, a care home like the Bush, it's why we pay our taxes, surely.
Of course, and that's why we're continuing. That's why Jimmy will be able to continue at the bush, and I think
appreciate that.
Let's let Rita have a final.
I appreciate that, but George, I know you say it's not a cut because what you're doing is you're taking money from the, what you want to do is close the five beds at the bush.
Well, five
and
beds costing
but
nearly
£350,000. Because I think what you're saying is you're going to offer more choices to people.
Yes.
You should leave the bush as a choice because when you reduce it by five beds to make it only five, it will be for more emergency cases because the bush does do emergencies. Sometimes a couple of times they've had to cancel our night. it because they've got an emergency, very severely, you know, disabled child. Yeah. You need to leave it as a choice, as a viable choice. The bush has been running for about 30 years. It has serviced so many parents and so many children. And like I say, my son Jimmy has actually come on since using the bush. It's more than
well,
just...
Well, he's lovely, your it's son more, Jimmy.
I know, he's
great.
He's an absolute
yeah.
angel.
Yeah.
It's actually an educational facility as well as a respite unit. It's so much more than it actually says. And yeah, fair enough. Offer parents the other, you know, foster or whatever. I mean, I get direct payments as well as the bush because of the nature of my son's disability.
And that's good, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, that's been
good.
A good move, having
but
direct
I really
payments.
I really do. That's why I'm here, is to please say, this is so much more than you can ever imagine. The bush is so much more amazing. Just to please leave it. Just to please leave it.
But
as
I think
as it is because
so if you decided not to do that, George, you're not going to.
It sounds like you've decided to cut
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, we have decided.
You've decided you're going to take the five beds.
We have decided.
That's absolutely. Could you,
those five
George?
Beds
I want to ask you. Could you call
going,
it? Could you please? I've asked one of your workers, Jean Pollard, to call a meeting for parents at the bush so that we can all completely understand it. Because we were given back in a meeting at the council in February, we were given to believe, because most of the councillors agree apparently that the bush should stay as it is, and we were given to believe that it was not going to get touched until at least maybe April, or until you had all the other foster care or whatever in place. Then we, out of the blue, we get a letter saying it's closing. The five beds are closing in September.
Well, you were misled if anybody gave you the impression
but we've been
that,
misled
that it was
all the
otherwise.
Way along.
Well, you
were,
certainly
you,
weren't misled by me because
could
I made
you call
it really
a meeting
clear.
For parents at the bush, because you have the authority and the power, obviously.
I don't
to do
see
it.
The point now. We've
there
made
is,
the decision
because, please,
is made.
Please, George, hang on.
I'm very,
I've only got a few minutes here, please.
Okay, your final say now, Rita.
Yes, because we got a letter saying that it's closing in September.
It's not
if
closing.
If you could call a meeting
it's
for
carrying
the parents,
on and
so
you
that
will
we
be
could,
able to carry on.
All the parents
it.
Are so confused. We would just like to have somebody front us, face us, man up, face us, tell us you're closing it, and give us,
well,
then
I'm,
tell us
look,
a random
I,
letter
I
through
am,
the post.
I am, told you
it's
that,
It's really
Rita.
Not good enough. It's quite insulting. So you're definitely going to close the five beds?
We're definitely going to close the
when?
Five beds. In September,
so you've
if that's
got,
what you've been
got,
told.
So you've got all the other...
I mean, I rely 50, on...
Have you got 50 foster parents to accommodate that? Maybe parents don't... I would never have put Jimmy into foster care. Mm. He's my son.
Well,
I don't want a
that's why you're not
foster
having
mother.
To. That's
well,
why,
I don't have
but
to.
But others are choosing
to
do
he's
so.
My son.
No, but...
Other parents, at the first meeting that was called, one parent said, putting my child into foster care, I might as well hand him to a paedophile. And we all know with the bush that these children are so safe because there's a team of staff.
Yeah,
I implore you
I
to change
many,
your decision,
can I say that many, many
George,
parents have taken an alternative view? And I know...
You say
I
that, I don't
understand.
Believe you, because I know more I know more parents of disabled children than you.
Well,
you
Rita, you
Rita,
made
your
we're
going
to have to move on.
I know.
So can you just say your final comment
but,
now?
But I don't
my
like
final
the
comment,
scaremongering.
George, please,
George,
I don't really care because these are the most vulnerable people in society, these disabled children.
Well, you know
and
I
they're going to stay
that.
Disabled forever.
You know
I am imploring
that.
You, George, please leave it. It will cause so much suffering for us and for future parents and disabled children. Please leave the bush.
Well, Rita,
as it
I
is.
Don't want to leave you with a wrong impression. The fact is, the bush will have five beds. Your son, Jimmy, who is a great spirit, and I've seen him is will be able to carry on using the bush. Others have chosen other paths. This will enable 50 more children to be able to benefit
I don't believe
from
you.
The funds that we save from those five beds.
Okay, well, thanks both of you for keeping it reasonable and reasonably polite. But anyway, I think you've both made your views very, very clear on that particular one, George. I mean, you know, George, you're a wealthy man, couldn't you?
I was going to say that. Can you put your
hand
in your pocket to help these children?
It's a ridiculous. It's a ridiculous thing that I'm not. I
went to see the Pope.
I went to see the Pope. Yeah, I know. And the Pope is wonderful, and I, you know, and I share his belief in humanity, but. I absolutely, you know, I'm not a rich man. You think I'm a rich man, can
you
solve all problems.
You,
no,
no, no, no, no.
I'm a social entrepreneur. I give a lot away, and it is a ridiculous refrain somehow that I can step in and replace.
Okay, George, that's a very clear no. Yeah. Can we move on now? Because the ex-Avon and Somerset police chiefs are saying Nick Gargan must go.
Thanks,
Nick Gargan,
Rita.
This is the former, thank you very much, Rita Lynch, and Jimmy, who's outside the studio. Nick Gargan was found guilty, as our chief constable, just about still, of 8 charges of misconduct last month, but has been allowed to return to work. 3 former Avon and Somerset chief constables have called for the current chief, Nick Gargan, to go to restore confidence in the force. Now, this is amazing, isn't it? I mean, the last chief constable, I think it was Colin Port, George, was here for over 10 years, and we've had Nick Gargan for just over a year, or is it maybe 2 years or something, and he spent most of his time suspended on full pay. What do you think that would be the best resolution to this?
Well, to be honest, I haven't heard what the charges are.
Misconduct, and I think the implication is some kind of inappropriate sexual behaviour.
Well, there were 2 sets of misconduct. I think there was data protection and inappropriate behaviour of that. I don't know whether it's sexual nature, but certainly inappropriate behaviour. Now, until I'm not prepared to make judgments, until I've seen what the results are.
Well, I think that's a very wise decision.
But I haven't, and nobody has. So there is some wild speculation going on.
So why are these 3 chief constables saying that he should go?
Well,
good question.
You know, I think let the chief constable who's never done wrong cast the first stone.
Well, I was going to say that, because Colin Port was involved in the very, very dubious inquiry into Rosemary Nelson. That's the Republican lawyer. He conducted an inquiry into her death, which found nothing, and it was based at the same police station in Northern Ireland where the death threats against her had been coming from. And Steve Pilkington, who was chief constable before him, is one of these police chiefs. Under him, there was a letter to the Home Secretary complaining about him from senior officers, saying that crime under him had gone up 20% and the clear-up rate at 14% was the lowest in the whole country. So who these chief constables are to talk, I really don't know.
Well, I make absolutely no judgment, other than the fact that I think that these judgments are a bit premature, and I trust Sue Mount-Stevens, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner, to come to the best resolution, but it's her job, not mine.
Don't investigate thefts, assaults or hit and runs, police are told. New policies emerged after Leicestershire police were ridiculed for not investigating burglaries at odd-numbered houses. This is British police forces which are refusing to investigate assaults, thefts and hit-and-run car crashes, prompting growing concern about priorities set by some chief constables. Of course, this is also, George, to do with the cuts in the police. It seems almost everything we do, I don't know, sometimes you feel like an official receiver as a politician nowadays, just doing cuts here and cuts there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have responsibility for the police, but it does sound absolutely ludicrous, the idea that you don't investigate odd-number house thefts, and presumably next year even number has thefts. That is, it's stuff for the joke columns of the newspapers.
But it's not if you're a victim of a
hit and run. You wouldn't think that was serious news,
I mean,
would you?
Yeah, but it's not if you're a victim of a hit and run.
Absolutely. No. I mean, it's just, I think it's horrendous, and I think some police constables have come out and said that is not appropriate, and that all these forms of crime should be investigated, every single one of them.
I mean, I think we've lost 800 police constables here in Avon and Somerset since the coalition government in 2010. It's almost like it almost seems to me to be like a kind of go out and commit crime if you can, because it's going to be easier.
I do keep close to the community police and find that there's they're doing a very good service in the city. So what I would like to do is praise the individuals who are policing this city, who I think are very sensitive in terms of the way they police the city, and enhance community relations rather than antagonising them. But yes, they are fiscally challenged like the rest of us.
A lot of our show tends to be horror stories, I'm afraid, and here's another one. This is based in Taunton. My mum died after being left in her own urine for 8 days. Daughter claims her tragic 69-year-old mum was left in a disgusting condition, says the Daily Mirror earlier this week. As carers neglected her and took away her dignity, a devastated woman has accused care workers of negligence following the death of her mum, who was left dying in a urine-soaked bed for 8 days. Margot Green, 69, was being visited by carers, I think you better put inverted commas over there, at her home, twice daily, but one day pressed her emergency alarm and was rushed to hospital. Doctors at Musgrove Park Hospital in Taunton found the pensioner was in agony with ammonia burns. Although medics confirmed she had an infection, she was too frail to have more tests and died 4 days later. Now, this doesn't sound like being looking after elderly people properly, George. It's pretty damn disturbing.
I mean, it's not in Bristol, but nevertheless, you know, we've always got to be alert to these issues. And
I mean, are you alert when you're putting services that used to be run in-house at the council out to private contractors? This was.
Well, we are. The issues arise. There are always going to be issues arising, whether there are direct services or not, but you know, we've got to react really quickly when those happen. That sounds like a horrific case.
I mean, isn't the idea really to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place?
Well, of course there is, but you know, nothing's perfect, and when you're running a city with 500,000 people, there are going to be some people who fall through the cracks. But it's absolutely inexcusable for the service, whether it's public or private, to treat somebody in that manner.
I mean, I'm not a great fan of the Daily Mail, but I read a fantastic...
Not a great fan, I think. I don't think either of us have a huge amount of respect.
But they did
Daily
have
Mail.
A fantastic headline, I think it was last year, The Cruelty of the Carers. Do you think that caring for people really sits happily with the idea of private profit being made from that?
I think it's patchy, isn't it? I mean, some are absolutely wonderful, and you know, buried my mum in March, and she lived 96. She did spend quite a lot of time in a home, and she was very beautifully looked after, and so that was, you know, maybe it was fortunate. But you hear the bad cases, don't you? I'm a occasional user of the NHS, and I have nothing for praise for them, you know, but you hear the bad stories.
But when people are visiting,
but you know, it is, we don't want any of those.
I mean,
bad
an
stories.
Institution is very different to people visiting someone caring for them at home, isn't it? Because it's kind of hidden. If they don't really quite do their job properly, or they skip 10 minutes and nip out for a cigarette, no one will know.
Absolutely. And so it's really important that we have the, yeah, that we have the inspections, which we do, that we have independent assessments, which we do. And I think that's all, yeah, that's very important. But if we are alerted to a particular case, we take it extremely seriously.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you've just hot-footed it from the M4. Well done for making it in.
Finally on
that. It's a bit difficult. Friday, Summers, westbound on the M4 is always, it's the big London rush hour, isn't it? Coming.
Where do you come
down.
From, Martin?
I've just come from London.
Oh, right. And, you couldn't have done it on your bike.
And the A303 is the same. You know, it's this rush hour every weekend, especially during the summer. Friday, everyone goes westwards on the M4 and the A303. And then on Sunday night, it's chaos in the other direction. Yeah. A gigantic, great rush hour. Maybe we should bring the fares down a little bit. First Great Western. Anyway, I'll put a few extra trains on. Martin, what are your thoughts about this this case in Taunton? Pretty shocking this week in the Daily Mirror. I haven't seen it reported much elsewhere. But can these private care companies really look after people in their own homes properly?
Well, I think the issue really is how we as a society in general value the kind of work that care workers do. I mean, I know that the privatisation of the in-house care system in Bristol was controversial at the time, but one of the obvious things was that the private sector contractors that took it over were paying a lot less than the public sector providers were. Now, of course, that's value for money for the ratepayer or council taxpayer or whatever, but I think whether it's publicly or privately provided, people who are going to look after people in their own homes are doing an extremely skilled and very important job, and I don't think we as a society actually value it enough to pay it at the rate it needs to be paid at, and to give people the time to do the job properly. And I think that is a serious issue. We've got to actually think, you know, I mean, there's plenty of competition for care work, so you could force the wages down quite dramatically if you want to. But the problem is that you then actually, if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys, and also the time factor is not being properly taken into account. I think in Scandinavian countries, I imagine they're paid a lot more, and they get a lot more time with each of their clients.
I mean, I'm always a little bit uncomfortable about the whole sort of trying to shift what should be a public service into the private sector, whether it works or not, George. What do you make of this in a general context? I mean, could you run Bristol? Does it work running it like a business?
I think, again, I hate generalisations. I think there are good and bad, both in the private and the public sector, and it's a matter of making judgments what's appropriate. Yes, I do think there are some services that are better put out to the private sector, but I think and there are some wonderful organisations, certainly in the voluntary and charitable sector, that are doing great work, that are contractors of ours. In strictly speaking, they're in the private sector, but they are dedicated in what they do.
Well, I'm talking more about for-profit businesses and whether that mentality works running a city. You're saying at least there are some things that you think, is there anything you could point to and say, well, here is a private sector company that's doing city council work, we're paying it for, and they're doing a fine job?
I think that some of the private sector people who are running care services are doing a good job, but I think it goes wrong when profit, that the bottom line becomes their main purpose.
And isn't that the purpose of every private business? They're looking at shareholders
it isn't. I think there are a lot of private businesses that are dedicated to the purpose of their business rather than just to the bottom line.
They're not charities, are they?
No, but
it depends who's running it.
Absolutely, yeah. But there are charities, but some excellent ones. But also, there are many private businesses that verge on being social enterprises as well.
One thing we can't not talk about, George, you can't talk to you without talking about it. Is guess what? Resident parking, because this is a lot of people, particularly in the poorer areas of the city, like St Paul's, are pointing to you and say, here's the tax man, yeah? We used to be able to park outside our house, now we've got to pay George's tax. And also, of course, they were also sitting there thinking, well, of course, every year visitor permits are going to be costing more, it's going to cost more just for a car permit for myself. It's just a nightmare for some people who just simply cannot afford to pay another tax living in the poorest end of the city.
Well, I find that absolutely ridiculous. You're talking about less than £1 a week in order to be able to have greater convenience, a better environment. Any of the money that eventually comes back goes into better transport. You probably save the amount in petrol and just from searching around looking for a parking space that you did before you had residence parking. Well, this has turned around, Tony. I was getting so much hassle. And every time a residence parking scheme comes in, 95% of the hassle goes away because people suddenly realise, oh, we're living in a much better place. I've had people say it's like being on holiday because the environment's so much better. And it's safer, it's easier for disabled people and prams to get around on the pavements because people aren't parking in a more ordered manner. I think most people realise while there are issues that need ironing out, while we are prepared to review parking schemes, especially after the first 6 months, and we will have continuous reviews, most people realise this is a huge benefit to the environment. I really feel we're winning on it.
What about this no mayor referendum that's now being discussed apparently by the House of Lords, and with Bristol particularly in mind here? We were hearing from Gary Hopkins last week that the Lords have passed, I don't know if it's an amendment, I think, I'm not sure quite, some sort of new bill or whatever it is. Not sure exactly what's been passed the House of Lords, but they are saying, well, what we need to do is change one of the existing laws about the mayors to allow Bristol to have a referendum to say we don't want a mayor.
Well, I'm relaxed about it. I've got, I think we're proving the case that Bristol's doing a damn sight better with a mayor than it did with the chopping and changing politics.
To as a really good couple of examples of things that you've done that couldn't have happened under the old system then?
Well, we're making decisions. We're getting on with things. We're building arenas. We're dealing with the environment. Yeah, absolutely.
You haven't got planning permission yet?
No, we haven't got planning permission. I don't think that
it's councillors, the council that awards it.
I don't think councillors are going to want to frustrate it, because I think they'd look damn stupid if they did. We're getting on with things, and we're not suffering from that. Old politics, and I'm reading both from within and without Bristol. I mean, actually, the further away you get from Bristol, the more people recognise the huge strides that are being made here.
Oh dear! Well, you might lose the referendum then. Further away think that it's a good idea.
Yeah, but I think sometimes people will catch up realising that we're much, much better off from having the mayoral system. I think there are some people who are a bit bitter about it, you know, because they lost out. And, Gary is always going to, he's always going to stamp his feet. That's what Gary does about anything I do, because he doesn't like the mayoral system. But, you know, some councillors don't. The university did a survey about recognition of leadership in the city, and it was a massive, massive improvement under the mayoral system, except amongst the councillors.
The arena, why can't a private sector do that, George? Why do we have to be stumping up our taxpayers' money to fund it?
Well, arenas traditionally can't, in their first few years, work just with the private sector.
But the private sector can borrow the money just like we can.
No, but don't worry. We'll be making money from the arena, not just the direct money that we'll be making in the long term, but also it's going to be a huge boost to the local economy. And there's great spin-off. The catalytic effects of what it's going to do in regeneration around the station are absolutely tremendous.
What about parking?
Parking, one of the worst things. I think people have got a very old-fashioned approach to parking for such things. I mean, if you go to the Cardiff Stadium, for instance, which seats, I think, up to 70,000 people, there's no parking for those people. And they enliven the city. They arrive, they do park and ride, they come by public transport,
they
come
park
by
in the local streets.
And they walk through the city. The same thing with rugby at Bath. And it's brilliant for the economy, because the more people walking through the city, the more people, you know, cars don't buy things, people do, and they stop and they have cups of coffee, and they use the shops on the way to the rugby or back. And actually, you know, I think people are blowing this way out of proportion. We're talking about a 12,000 capacity arena. It will only be 12,000 capacity use a few times in the year. More often, it's going to be between 5,000 and 10,000.
So are you making sure that the financial case for the arena is all open before councillors, before the city signs up to it?
We've been very open about it. I think, you know, I think some councillors want to find something to knock, because they see it as a project that I've driven through. But
what about us citizens? Can we see the figures? Are we allowed to look at them?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And you have. I'm not hiding anything. It's a £90 million project. Just over £90 million project. Plus the infrastructure costs that we're putting in the bridge at the moment, which is just about to swing into position at the end of the month to open up Arena Island. It's a wonderful regeneration project. The worst thing, and that's why I say people have an old-fashioned idea, the worst thing would be to put general parking at the arena. All that means, everybody would aim to get to that parking. You'd have an almighty traffic jam getting into it, or mighty traffic jam coming out of it. So it's absolutely vital that we only have essential operational and disabled parking close to the arena. Otherwise, we make sure that the parking is spread and obviously reduce as much as possible. We will use smart systems that there will be an app for people arriving to any event in Bristol that enables them to find the most convenient parking, their best way of getting there from there to the arena. So I'm absolutely sure that this is going to work, and it's going to enliven the city. There will be some areas that come under certain pressure, and we will be introducing parking and parking arrangements to make quite sure that the residents don't unduly suffer from it.
Okay, George. Well, also, the other big project at the moment is this metro bus. Again, people pointing fingers saying, well, actually, other parts of the country, Cambridge, Bedford, places like that, where they've tried these guided bus rails, they haven't been very successful. And Kerry McCarthy, MP, she was on here saying, well, I was a councillor in Luton, and I can tell you it was a bit of a disaster over there. People weren't using it, nowhere near as many as people were told were using it. Also in France, they had this similar system for a few years in one of the cities in France, worked with it for about 5-6 years and decided to scrap it.
Well, eventually. You're looking at all the failures. We've learned. I mean, the great thing about not being the first is we learn from these things, and there are many, many examples across the world where the equivalent bus rapid transport, metro bus, is working extremely well. Our fellow European Green Capital of Nantes, that was Green Capital in 2013, is one example where they've got trams, but they've also got what they call trackless trams, which is what, you know, Metrobus essentially is.
Can't we just have a tram? Doesn't it make more sense to have a tram?
Well, if you could produce me a few billion... Yes, we can have a tram. We're having to do this on £200 million altogether, and that is it's going to be a good value system that's going to increase the viability of the city in the way that it gets people around the city. And you know, housing, which I've talked about, transport are both absolutely essential in terms of increasing productivity, getting people to and from work, and making the city a more pleasant place to live in.
What about jobs? I know the local enterprise partnerships charge with trying to generate more jobs, money going in to help business to generate more jobs. But there are questions. I mean, we had a discussion here just before the May local elections, and several of the party leaders, I think it was Labour and Green, were saying, well, the local enterprise partnership actually isn't accountable. It's a private company, so the public aren't allowed along to its meetings. And the minutes aren't published until quite a long time after, and they're making big decisions, or at least recommendations, about how vast amounts of millions of pounds are spent. Now, you're on the local enterprise partnership. Tell us about
well,
a bit
I'm
about
on it.
Well,
I'm because I'm an elected representative.
Tell us about it.
And so are the three other leaders of the surrounding authorities. So
their complaint, effectively, is that there's not enough representation from the voluntary sector or small businesses on there at all. It's all sort of high-power, big business types.
No, it isn't. If you look at the whole workings of the local enterprise partnership, it is. It's not as broadly representative as we'd like. Neither is the city council.
Well, you can change it, George.
You know, the city council is
you're
not as broadly
representative. You can change it.
Well, we're doing. You will find there is pretty good breadth of representation, but yeah. I mean, it happens to be that the four leaders of the authorities concerned are all middle-aged white men, so that doesn't give a great spread. So there are certain things that you know, and that is stipulated. They're the core members of the.
Don't you think
the
people should be elected onto there, rather than as appointed by big business?
Well. The whole purpose that the government had was not to make this yet another elected body, but an effective one that is representative of business. And I think it is right that there's an organisation that does have input from business. After all, it is business. And the universities are included in there as business, as you call it. They're the people who are creating the jobs, and I want to, and the LEP's been extremely successful at that. We've created over 2,000 jobs now within the enterprise zone. We're heading to create another 15,000 in its lifetime over the next 25 years. So and we're well on course to doing so. So.
Well, the
creation of jobs by any means. I'm not bothered, to be honest, about the means. I'm bothered about the outcome. And I think that while there are things you can always criticise about any institution, the LEP included, I think that Bristol greatly benefits from the LEP and the enterprise zone. And we took the James Wharton, the minister, around yesterday, and he was extremely impressed with what we're doing. Went away with very positive messages to government, and I have to say that the chair of the LEP, Colin Skellick, played a vitally important part in giving, in making sure that he could understand what we are doing.
And Western College were, I'm not sure if they still are, but they've awarded themselves, effectively, millions of pounds of public money in order to refurbish the winter gardens in Weston-super-Mare, which they bought for a pound. I mean, this is, it does sound as if this is an organisation which is simply using public money to increase their own business opportunities.
Well, each of the four authorities choose what their projects are, and they're, you know, reasonably fairly distributed. I don't have responsibility for choosing what the North Somerset projects are, but what I'm absolutely sure is, and I, my great interest is in what projects happen in and for Bristol, and I'm absolutely sure that we're benefiting hugely from those projects, which includes the arena.
We've had also two stories to do with former Conservative leaders, Michael Howard and also Ted Heath this week. I'll get you first on this, Martin Summers. It's quite amazing to have the same day two stories about potential criminal activities of two Conservative leaders. There's the accusations of child abuse against Ted Heath and also fraud against Michael Howard.
Well, I mean, these things come back to bite people if they are guilty, don't they? I think there's all sorts of things that have gone on in the past which are gradually coming to light, and not just in the Conservative Party. Lord Janner, who's a Labour peer, has been in court this week, I understand, as well.
George, what's your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, really, I think most people would agree it's kind of started with the Jimmy Savile expose, and now more people are actually, some of them, going back to the police, where they've been to the police, giving them evidence about child abuse in the past and not been listened to.
I think it's a good thing there's greater awareness and people are being given the courage to come forward. It's a bad thing where people are falsely accused, obviously. And I don't know. I don't know the facts. I just worry about jumping to any conclusions. And I think you've got to allow people to be innocent until proved guilty. And I think there is a tendency in the media to prejudge, so I'm not going to prejudge anything. You know, there are some people somehow you weren't surprised about, but I was surprised the extent of the Jimmy Savile demeanors, which are absolutely appalling. You know, I say some people you weren't surprised about. You know, he's always seemed such a creepy individual to me, but I don't think that that is, you know, I don't think you could say that of Ted Heath, and I would be hugely surprised.
George, finally, question on the new government's, or the government's new extremism strategy. I just wonder if you think that that's helping with community relations. I heard recently that one of the Sikh leaders has been told that even though he's been here for 10 years, he's got to leave.
Well, I don't think it was. I think it was particularly clumsy the way that it was introduced, and I do think, because I've talked a lot of the leaders of different communities, I think there's a feeling now that ministers are listening more, so there have been moves in the right direction, but I think there's more talking to be done. But I'm proud of the way that Bristol seems to hold down extremism, and it's something I talk about a lot, because it's vitally important to me that we have communities and cultures and faiths that get on with each other, and I think accusing people automatically of extremism is extremely dangerous.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. After the Murdoch News, LIBOR trader Tom Hayes is jailed for 14 years, but is the long sentence a just punishment, or to keep him from giving evidence to journalists in the courts about his managers and directors?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.